Good Tuesday afternoon. Welcome to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. And today we are going to be talking about an Article 5 convention and why we should be against that idea. It's called a con. It's more reason than one that it's a con. But the fact is that the Constitutional Convention being proposed by some people in this country would be an absolute nightmare. And we need everything in our power to stop this, because if it actually happens in a woke environment, we're in serious trouble. Today, my guest will be Robert Brown from the John Birch Society. Robert has put together a great program called the Constitution is the Solution. He's an expert on this issue of constitutional conventions. And Ed Regan, who is a Montana activist who's been involved in this entire process. Join us on the other side of the break.
Your own government has the power to activate a kill switch on all telecommunications, instantly shutting down all private phone calls and texts. An EMP weapon or solar flare can achieve the same result. Rolling blackouts or permanent power outages will also take out the power supply to cell tower antennas, rendering mobile devices all but useless. During these emergencies, how do you stay in touch with the important people in your life anywhere on the planet? The answer is the Bivy Stick at SAT123.com. The Bivy Stick is a two-way satellite text messaging device that uses a satellite constellation, not cell towers, to send and receive text messages. It works anywhere on planet Earth, including in war zones or blackout areas. In unpredictable times, the Bivy Stick helps you stay connected when it matters most. Visit SAT123.com to get one while they're still available.
The Kelly Key easily converts your AR rifle to bolt action, allowing you to keep the rifle you love in assault weapon jurisdictions. The Kelly Key is a true fast drop-in solution. No permanent changes to your rifle. Import, transport, own, and have fun with your AR. Why the Kelly Key? Because a bolt action is not an assault weapon. Stay future ready from gun bans with the Kelly Key. The Kelly Key also lets you quickly and easily build your ideal hunting rifle, lets you build a quiet and suppressed rifle, and benefits your long-range precision shooting. Available now at KellyKey.com with free shipping.
Many watching Bridie on TV will remember the fiery speech from Dr. Alan Keyes at the annual State Republican Dinner that ended in repeated standing ovations. Dr. Keyes has been an articulate and passionate spokesman for faith, convictions, and consistently strong enough to resist the tug of political convenience. Alan pierces through the ethical haze of our time and calls us to stand up for the truth, knowing that you cannot have the right to do wrong. Get your download of Our Character, Our Future, an audiobook by Dr. Alan Keyes, exclusive to the Bridie on TV audience. Dr. Alan Keyes personally read and recorded our exclusive audiobook version of his timeless essays in Our Character, Our Future for this very special promotion. You can order it by going to www.imtv.us and click on Special Offer. It's available at only $19.95 for a very limited time. You'll not only enjoy a tremendous savings, but you'll get an amazing piece of literature read by Dr. Alan Keyes himself. Get yours today. Go to www.imtv.us.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. And today we're going to be talking about Article 5 conventions and why people need to be actively engaged in that process to stop Article 5 conventions. My guests today are Robert Brown from the John Birch Society. He has done an excellent program called The Constitution is a Solution, and he's probably the foremost expert in the country on constitutional issues. He's also done a very good program on why we need to avoid an Article 5 convention. And with him today is a friend of both of ours, Ed Regan, who is an activist from Montana. He's worked with the Montana legislature, and we've got another con attempt going before the legislature tomorrow, and we need to do everything in our power to stop it. Robert, thank you for being our guest. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's always good to be with you, and it's good to see Ed Regan again. Likewise. It's
always good to see Ed Regan.
That's
he's
right.
He's one of the foremost patriots in this country. Let's get started talking about why a constitutional convention is a really, really bad idea and why it is such a bad idea, especially in today's political environment.
Yes, certainly. You know, I want to begin with just quickly defining what that is, that in Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, it defines two ways of making changes to the Constitution. The first way, amendments are proposed by Congress and get sent out to the states for ratification. The second way we have never used, and I would say for good reason. The second way is when two-thirds of the state legislatures apply for a convention to Congress. Congress then calls a convention for proposing amendments that then goes out to the states for ratification as well. In both cases, ratification also has two options. It could be ratified by state legislatures, or Congress could say, no, we're going to use special ratifying conventions bypassing the state legislature. Either way, this is a convention whose sole purpose is to create new amendments to the Constitution. And the very first time it was proposed to ever be used was in 1788, right after the Constitution had been written and ratified. And James Madison personally made sure that did not happen. So he's really the original opponent to having an Article 5 convention, and I echo a lot of his concerns. I want to start with a question, though. If we were to have a convention being promoted as a totally open convention, would you support it as a totally open convention where everything's on the table, anything and potentially everything in the Constitution could be changed, and the convention would have the power to write its own rules for ratification? As I've traveled the country teaching the Constitution and teaching about the Article 5 Convention, I've asked that question to thousands of people. I think I've had a total of two people that ever said they might consider that. And the reason I bring that up is, if we were promoting this honestly, if Convention of States and other groups were honest about what the convention could be, which is what we just described here, that is what the historical and legal precedents show. The convention can do anything, and it can write its own rules for ratification. We'll get into some of that history. And nobody would be signing up for that. The state legislatures would not be applying for this convention if it were being promoted honestly. And so that's really why I'm so fired up about this topic and why I'm traveling the country trying to set the record straight about historical and legal precedent that applies to an Article 5 convention. Because if it's being presented honestly, they're not supporting it.
Sense. And in doing that, I know that you've got a perspective that says in today's political climate, just exactly what could we expect if we did have that kind of an open-ended convention? And in that regard, please bring that those points up, because I think people need to understand just how radical this thing could be.
I guess the first question is, and that one's 14. Let's go back one slide. There we go. Perfect. So that one, the first question on the list, who chooses the delegates? Because he who chooses the delegates chooses the outcome. And if, Dan, if you and I are the ones handpicking the delegates to the convention, it would be a completely different convention than if people like Barack Obama or Nancy Pelosi were handpicking the delegates. And so who chooses these delegates, and what type of delegates can we expect they're going to choose? Historically, we've seen state legislatures have been tasked with that kind of a role. So that's the general assumption, is that our state legislators are going to choose the delegates. And I always ask, if you're in a conservative state like Montana, let's ask Ed on this one. You're an activist in Montana. Would you be comfortable with your state legislature choosing the delegates, and what type of delegates do you think they'd choose? Do you think they'd be constitutional conservatives, moderates, or liberals?
Well, probably moderates, and I wouldn't be happy with that.
Yeah.
They certainly would not be the statesmen that we had back in 1787.
Yeah, absolutely. And so if we have a convention, the most conservative states, that's the answer I always get, by the way. Our state's probably going to send moderates. And of course, in the more liberal states, they're definitely going to be sending liberals to represent that state. So a convention of moderates and liberals debating and discussing what will the future constitution look like. I'm not very comfortable with that. The next one on here, do you think lobbyists would have any interest in the convention and its outcome? Do you think there would be any lobbying going on? Absolutely. This would be the biggest lobbyist event in history. And so, of course, if you're a lobbyist and you're lobbying a state legislature and you have a certain size budget, do you think that budget's going to be bigger or smaller for the convention? Yeah, absolutely. They're going to be pouring far more money into lobbying the convention than they do in a regular legislative session in your state. So lobbyists have a huge interest in the outcome of this type of a convention. The next one on here, do you think the convention would be live streamed or private? And I have problems with both of those. Of course, if it's private closed door session, that's what they did in 1787 when the current US Constitution was written. They closed the doors, they were forbidden to speak to anyone from the press between each state's hearings and so on. In fact, Madison, his notes that he took day by day, which are awesome, by the way, if you want to know what happened in that convention, but he forbade them being published until after his death. He wanted all the delegates to have pretty well passed on by the time that people actually found out how our Constitution came to be, who voted for and against different provisions and so on. So they didn't want any political pressure on them even after the fact. Now, if it were live streamed on C-SPAN, for example, I see a huge problem with that as well. But if, let's say Montana was smart enough to send Ed Regan to be a delegate to this convention, and Ed is not towing the Marxist line, he's not supporting various things that certain liberal groups want in that constitution, do you think that they would dox him, publish his private residence address, where the angry mobs now know where to show up with their torches and pitchforks to threaten himself and his family if he doesn't go along with the massive sweeping changes they want? Is that a political reality today? Is doxing being used as public pressure in politics? Is that something that's even a reality today? Or am I just
Boy,
making
howdy.
Stuff up here? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's something I really want to emphasize with each of these is this is our current political environment. The next one, do you think more extreme groups like Antifa, BLM, and others would have any interest in the outcome of the convention? And when things don't go their way, do you think that their protests would be peaceful protests or just mostly peaceful protests? I mean, you can see where this is going. And again, that's our political reality today, isn't it? That various tools like this being used to try to influence public opinion, as well as people in positions of power. The next question on the list is, if by some chance there happened to be a mass shooting near the time of the convention, do you think that might be used to try to influence the convention? It's time to solve this gun problem once and for all. While we're making changes to the Constitution, let's solve this problem. Again, highly likely. And do you think the media would try to manipulate public opinion with such an event? Of course they would. They always do. Mm-hmm. And then the last question on this is, do you think Russia, China, or the United Nations would have any interest in the outcome of our convention and possibly try to influence it? And again, we've seen plenty of evidence that's exactly what they would do. So this is what I refer to as the present temper of America, our current political environment. Madison, I mentioned, he was the first one to stop a convention when they, right after the U.S. Constitution was written and ratified, the year after it was written, 1788, it was ratified, and there already began to be a movement for, let's use the Article 5 Convention to create the Bill of Rights. And Madison spoke out quite a few times against using the convention route. In fact, he just defined that the amendments through Congress would be the safer method. And in one letter he wrote, this one's to George Turberville, November 2nd, 1788, he says, having witnessed the difficulties and dangers of the 1787 convention where the Constitution was written, I should tremble for the result of a second meeting in the present temper of America. I want to emphasize what that present temper was. He explained that the Constitution at the time had been adopted but not implemented yet. They weren't using their Constitution yet. And before we have a convention that could come in and make major changes to the Constitution they'd never even tried yet, why don't we first give it a few years of living under the Constitution before we suggest any possible additional changes to it? I'd say we're in exactly that same circumstance today. Today, we've really hardly used the Constitution we already have. And if we were to try using the Constitution again, let's obey it for a few years and see how many of the problems they're trying to solve with the convention will go away. I'd point to one of them, for example, our spending problem. They point to, well, we would need a balanced budget or other ways of curbing federal spending. Let's try the Constitution. Because by my estimation, roughly 80% of federal spending is not constitutional. And if we were to begin obeying the Constitution again, we'd have roughly $2 trillion of surplus in the federal budget every year. That's a massive difference from where we are today. And the federal government at that point would be far less abusive and intrusive into our daily lives. It would be almost unrecognizable how different the federal government would be than it is today. So that's our present temper of America, what a convention would look like today. And frankly, I see serious problems having a convention open up the Constitution today in today's political environment. I would call it suicidal to try to open the Constitution in today's political environment.
I think that's absolutely true. Ed, you've been through this process. They've tried con-cons in the state of Montana for a long time. Talk about how this whack-a-mole keeps popping up because they never give up. They keep trying over and over again to get a constitutional convention. And every time they seem to make a little bit of headway. Talk a little about your experience in fighting a Article 5 convention in the state of Montana.
Well, I first got interested in it in the, I think it was 1987. Phyllis Schlafly came out and testified. I believe it was the balanced budget amendment back then. And it seems like every session they just keep coming at you. And Montana has actually killed every Article 5 proposal since the mid-80s. And we have actually, in 2007, there was a House-Senate Joint Resolution 38 that rescinded every call that was still on the books from Montana that dated all the way back to 1905 through the 60s. So we wiped the slate clean, and we've been able to, you know, defeat this thing in every session that I've been all the way up to this one. Though the last few times it's getting a little more difficult. I don't know why. I think the COS people are, you know, just putting a lot of money out there and, misinformation and trying to, turn people in favor of it. And it's a very, it's a very complicated issue. You just can't take a soundbite and, you know, think that that's going to be the answer. So I've been involved with the Republican Party at the local level. Our committee, I've been the chairman of the local central committee in Broadwater County, and we've studied this thing. I've actually supplied information to all the committee members and the precinct people, and we took a vote on it a couple of months ago that we were going to oppose this as a committee, and I will be testifying to that fact tomorrow at the hearing that the whole committee is against us, and part of our position was the Republican platform that was just came out this summer from Billings, I'll quote, paraphrase it. It says, we stand in defense against weakening the United States Constitution. And, you know, our committee feels that, with this legislative history and all these turndowns of these almost 20 sessions in a row, that must tell us something. And we're not willing to take any chances with the with opening it up, and people are pretty leery in this county. And so I've also used some of my connections. I've got to meet a lot of the county chairman at the convention, and most of them guys, especially the rural guys, they're all good grassroots people, and most, you know, a lot of them believe as we do on this. So I'm just trying, I'm getting some debate going within that, within those circles. And we are, you know, we have some committees that are going to join us in opposition to this. I believe Madison County and Park County, and I just found out this afternoon that Sweetgrass County is one of their representatives is going to come over and weigh in opposition to it. So, you know, working those people that I know in the party on the state level, and also our local committee, and then just friends of mine from all around the state that I've met in my 45 years of looking for trees to cut. You know, I've contacted all those good conservative people that I know and asked them if they would please contact their senators and representatives, but senators right now, because this thing is in the Senate, and we are putting a lot of pressure on some of them. And I've heard that they've told me that, you know, they're getting a lot of emails from the Convention of States people, which I'm not sure how much of this is machine generated or real legitimate, but you know, it's probably one of those deals where you press a button and it goes and says you're opposed. Well, not much thought goes into those. So I'm just trying to, you know, wake people up that you need to take a close look at this thing. You can't just decide off of a soundbite or two. So that was one of the reasons we decided as a committee that we do that. And I would hope that the Republican Party, we can change it from within. And I think we're making some progress. We're not all the way there. Not everybody agrees with us, but we're trying.
Right. And Ed, this is something I want Robert to get a chance to discuss, because it used to be the perception that it's only the conservatives that are trying to get this constitutional convention, this Article 5 convention. And in fact, it is both sides of the aisle, and both extreme sides of the aisle are, a lot of them are thinking different ways, but they're going in the same direction. Glenn Beck announced that he went from being a pro-con guy to an anti-con guy. And part of the reason is because he realized where George Soros was putting his money was into some of these groups that are pushing, these liberal groups that are pushing a constitutional convention. Robert, I want you to kind of describe how this conglomeration of people have innocently, in many cases, come together thinking they're doing the right thing.
Yeah. You know, this idea of having a convention, if you never heard anything except for the propaganda being put out there by Convention of States, for example, it might sound like a good thing. It's in the Constitution. It's for such a time as this, and claims like that. And then, of course, they promise the convention can be limited to specific topics, so it's very safe. All these claims that they cannot back up, but that sound good. And until you've heard the other side of the story, unless you are doing the research yourself, digging into the history like I've done, it sounds good. And yet, as you mentioned, there are groups on both sides of the aisle that are against it, and there are groups on both sides of the aisle that are in favor of it. I had a one-on-one debate with Mark Meckler about a year ago, in which he's saying, you're siding with all these liberal organizations that are Soros-backed, you're standing with Soros opposing us. I said, well, you have a letter from about 200 liberal groups that say they're against having the convention. But I have a list of over 700 liberal organizations that have endorsed a convention. So who's siding with the liberals on this? He says, yeah, but none of them have endorsed us. So, well, what about The Nation magazine? They specifically endorsed you. At which point he changed the topic, didn't want to talk about The Nation magazine at all. And I want to point out what's in The Nation magazine article. This came out just a few years ago. in which, number one, they say the U.S. Constitution is over 200 years old, and implying that it's outdated and it's time to have a new constitution for who we are as a nation today. And then they suggest the best way to accomplish that is for liberals to support the Convention of States organization and to help them get their convention. And then once we get to the convention, if they get to consider their proposals, we get to bring ours to the table as well. They're planning to hijack the convention. In fact, one of the quotes in there says, about when it comes to runaway conventions, we should embrace the idea of having a runaway convention. Given specific limits of power, let's blow past those limits and do anything we want. You can see why I didn't want to get into that topic.
That is a great subject. We'll see you on the other side of the break, and we'll bring that subject up.
The world we once knew is collapsing. We're being warned to expect rolling blackouts, and our political leaders are deliberately shutting down pipelines, fuel refineries, nuclear power plants, and energy exploration. The currency is collapsing, while financial assets are plummeting in value, and the global food supply is being deliberately decimated. To survive this war being waged on humanity, you need more than just regular prepping. You need resilient prepping. And that's the title of my new free audiobook, Resilient Prepping. You can download the entire audiobook and a printable PDF transcript for free right now at resilientprepping.com. Resilient Prepping teaches practical strategies for prepping in three layers: high-tech, low-tech, and no-tech. Resilient Prepping is your ultimate guide to surviving the total collapse of the world as we know it, because that's exactly what globalists are trying to achieve. Download this entire audiobook for free right now at resilientprepping.com. At the Brighteon store, we offer a variety of colloidal silver solutions that we make in Texas using Texas rainwater and specialized circuitry that I personally designed to produce silver ions in purified rainwater. We have a colloidal silver extra strength spray, a silver-based first aid gel, as well as a colloidal silver herbal mouthwash solution that people just rave about. Each one of these is subjected to our rigorous laboratory testing for metals, glyphosate, and microbiology in order to ensure product purity and safety for your health. We manufacture our own silver products right in the heart of Texas and deliver them to you using our own warehousing and fulfillment infrastructure that we built to serve real America. All of us here at Brighteon thank you for your support. Shop our silver products at brighteonstore.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. And before we went to the break, Robert Brown was talking about why we need to be alarmed that as many liberal groups as conservative groups are supporting this constitutional convention idea. There's a reason for that. Robert, go ahead and continue that discussion, please.
Yeah, absolutely. And you'd mentioned that Glenn Beck, this was on September 15th of this past year, that he announced, I'm no longer a supporter of this convention process. I think that was a great, humble admission that, you know what, maybe I was wrong. It takes a lot of courage to do that. But where we are today, there are liberal organizations pushing for an Article 5 convention. Wolfpack, for example, is one that's pushing for particular amendments that they want to see. But those have not gotten very much traction. Very few states have signed on to that amendment, that convention application. And so, as mentioned in the Nation magazine article that I'm referring to, their strategy is more suggesting, let's just hijack the conservative convention. Let's help them get their convention and then we can hijack it. Because, and this is the important point, a convention, they're promising the state legislators, you can limit this convention. It's totally safe, as I mentioned earlier. If we call for a convention for a balanced budget amendment, they'll promise the legislators that's the only thing that can be on the agenda. And based on historical and legal precedent, that is absolutely untrue. So I want to get into this a little bit. What is the historical precedent? We've only ever had one convention of the states that actually changed our national constitution. That happened in 1787, where the US Constitution was written. We originally had the Articles of Confederation. When those were found to be inadequate, the states got together with the instructions to render that federal constitution adequate. And they were given limits of power on that. Now, the other side of the argument here, Mark Meckler is going to say, oh no, that convention had full authority. The first thing Mark Meckler points to is we look at their commissions. Look to their commissions. When you as a delegate, Ed, when Montana is smart enough to send you as a delegate, they give you your commission. You are hereby authorized to represent Montana at this convention. And we're limiting you to amendments of a federal nature. That's what happened in 1787. And Mark Meckler says, as we look to their commissions, let's look at the slide here. Here's what he actually said. These are two different radio interviews spanning about 3 years, 2 to 3 years here, in which the first one he says, the first seven states to call the convention had this language in their commissions. The commissioners have any and all authority necessary. Well, that sounds like an unlimited convention, doesn't it? All authority necessary to render the federal constitution adequate. A couple of years later, he now says all of them except for one. So that'd be 11 states because 12 were in attendance. All of them except for one had this language in it. The commissioner has any and all authority necessary. And again, there's that same language. So he's saying a majority, whether it's 7 or 11, or somewhere in between, have this language in it. So I would expect if we go read those commissions, you're gonna find that language in at least half of them, if not more. Is it 7? Is it 11? How many is it? And the actual answer is, well, I've read all their commissions. I found it in exactly 0. When he says it has this language in it, I didn't find that language in even one of them. Because I've offered a $10,000 challenge. I've been offering this for about a year and a half now, and so far no takers. Number one, Meckler claimed that 7 or 11, a majority anyway, had this language in their commissions. The commissioner has any and all authority. So step one, find me even one commission that has that language in it. Because I read them, I couldn't find it. Number two, if it were true, do you think the delegates knew what was in their commissions? Because this issue came up as a question. They were concerned. Do we actually have the authority to be making the changes we're proposing to the Constitution? And when that issue came up, if they had read their commissions and it had that language in it, someone would have said so. Here's my commission. It says we have any and all authority necessary. So we're free to proceed. And then lastly, you should be able to show that that was ultimately the majority view that yes, we've been authorized to do this, and so we can proceed. That would be exactly what would have happened if their language, if their commissions had that language in them. So that's my $10,000 challenge. If what Mark Meckler is saying is true, this should be easy money. And I can't figure out why I haven't had a single taker yet. But that's the problem. If what he's saying is not true, if they truly did not have any and all authority, then we have to admit the 1787 convention set a precedent of a runaway convention, a convention that was given limited powers and that ignored those limits. And that's exactly what actually happened. We can get into that in more detail here, but $10,000 challenge, who's gonna take me up on this? Either convention states is telling the truth and I should be $10,000 poorer, or we admit that the 1787 convention was a runaway convention.
I think I mentioned this to you, but I'd like to see if we can increase that and turn that into a bet. I would like to see a public debate between the pro Article 5 people and you. Now, talk about a one-man band. You by yourself against as many experts as they want to bring forward to talk about what really transpired in the 1787 convention, was it a runaway? And there's no question, it was.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. Michael Ferris, he's one of the co-founders of the Convention of States organization, and he wrote an article that showed up in the Harvard Law Journal that essentially it's like 40 pages, and supposedly it proves the 1787 convention wasn't a runaway convention. The first thing my lawyers pointed out to me is that that journal that it was published in is a pay-to-play publication. In other words, this wasn't some scholarly article published by Harvard Law. It was, he paid to have this article put in there as an advertising piece. Interesting. But number two, guess what that entire 40 plus pages does not have? It doesn't have any of those points I just mentioned in my $10,000 challenge. It doesn't show anywhere that they had unlimited authority in their commissions. It doesn't show any delegate who said, yes, my commission grants us unlimited authority. Here's the language right here. It doesn't have any of the key parts of, was this really a runaway convention or not? They'll hold up that article and say, look, this is proof. Well, have you read that proof? Well, no. Very few people have read it. They're just going to hold it up there as, see, we have our proof, knowing that almost nobody is going to read it. Just like the commissions. Who has read those commissions and know, besides me, who knows what they actually say? Very few. So if we don't know, they can bluff. And I'm here to call out their bluff. $10,000 is as much as I have available to put out on the table. But I'm serious about this. They, a year and a half, you'd think at least one of their supporters somewhere would say, you know what, I've got that information. I'll come out there and claim that $10,000. If they could.
I've done a similar thing with UN Agenda 21. Putting a program together and challenging somebody to prove me wrong, and that I would give a $1,000 cash bonus on that. And I've had that same guarantee for, I think I'm going to say about 12 years, maybe 13. So, and I'd be happy to pay it, but I don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. The other topic you were mentioning was the topic of debate. And I think it's important to point out that about 3 years ago, in a presentation Mark Meckler was giving in Boise, Idaho, he said, I will take on anyone on this topic. I'm willing to stand up against any scholar out there. And someone from the audience said, will you debate Robert Brown on this? Absolutely not, was his reply. And at that point, we've begun to issue him regularly invitations to debate. We held an event in Boise, Idaho about a year or so later, and invited him to either attend or tell us a better time that works for his schedule. We'll reschedule it. He never replied. Last legislative session in Montana, the Senate leadership sent him a certified letter inviting him to debate me in the Montana Senate chambers, and he did not reply to it. I happened to run into him about a year later. It was 2022, February. I was in Iowa, ran into him there and said, you got the letter, it's a certified letter, we show that you received it. When are you going to debate me? And his answer was, that will never happen. I wonder why. He says I'm a liar, I say he's a liar. I think we have mutual respect that way. And the reason I want to debate him is because he's lying, and I would love the opportunity to publicly challenge him on his claims. If he thinks I'm a liar, publicly challenge me, embarrass me over my claims. Great, let's do it. Because if you have nothing to hide, if you know you're right, you'll welcome a debate. But if not, you'll do as Mark Meckler is doing and evade every opportunity for debate. He's actually officially, we've caught this from several of their top leaders around the country, he has told throughout his organization to his local leaders, do not debate Robert Brown. And in most cases, they don't. I've had a few of them agree to debate anyway, but it's very rare. Ed has his hand raised over there.
Just to reiterate what you're saying there, Robert, is I've talked to our senator on the Business, Labor, and Economic Affairs Committee, which this SJ2 resolution has gone before, and I asked him, now, how much time are we going to have to testify? And he checked with the chairman, and he says, you're only going to get 3 minutes. And I said, well, I hope to heck Rick Santorum only gets 3 minutes, and I guess we'll see what happens. But to to really rule and vote on this issue, as complex as it is, I think every senator ought to be able to see this public debate on the floor of the Senate. Otherwise, you shouldn't be voting on it. Most of them are just taking a soundbite or how much pressure they get from home and not really thinking of the unintended consequences. And one of the things I really worry about is, besides some of our most cherished freedoms being taken for granted and endangered, is the fact that a new convention might decide to enshrine all the unconstitutional behavior of the last 100 years. And all of a sudden, you got all the alphabet soup federal agencies and all the administrative laws and decisions that goes with it. They're all of a sudden upgraded and normalized. So that's another big worry that I have and I will be mentioning. So anyhow, didn't want to interrupt, but I do think that debate is very important that those guys see that.
Absolutely. Well,
that leads to the next question I'm going to ask Robert, and that is, let's say that they get their constitutional convention, they get their convention of the states, and some of the people who are conservatives get caught up in this and they realize that things are getting out of control. Is there a way to stop this process once it's fully underway?
There is not. Once we've reached the threshold of 2/3 of the states applying for the convention, it's out of the hands of the states at that point. Congress calls the convention, and once the convention's called, the only control over the convention is within the convention. The convention delegates themselves. What they choose to do or not do is totally up to them. And based on historical precedent, they can do whatever they want. There have been so many state cases as well where they've pointed to what happened in 1787. The convention literally transformed itself. It was called as a convention of the states, representing the states, limited by the states. Just like the way the Articles of Confederation were formed. Articles of Confederation, the first line of it says, "We, the undersigned delegates of the states." It was formed by the states' delegates there. The 1787 convention was a convention of the states. They came in there as representatives of the states, and they said, "We can't do this within the confines the states gave us." So they transformed themselves to, "We're going to represent the people. We're going to have the people ratify and retroactively give us approval for what we've done here." So by changing the ratification process, they also changed the convention. It was no longer a convention of states. It was now a convention of, what does the first line of the Constitution say? "We, the people." So they went in voicing the power of the people themselves as they became a totally different convention, totally unlimited convention. That's the precedent. That's the concern that we have here.
I would go so far as
courts of law too.
That's right.
I would say that Madison's justification for, turning it into a convention representing the people, we could probably start calling that the sovereign delegate doctrine, because it definitely is not going anywhere, and that precedent's not going to get changed, and it's exactly what's going to happen if they do get another one going. So.
When they decided they did not have the authority from their states and they changed the ratification process, Madison explains how and why they did that. The upper left quote there, "They chose to exercise the transcendent and precious right of the people to abolish or alter their governments." He's there paraphrasing the Declaration of Independence, the right of the people to throw off a government and create a new one if they felt necessary. The second quote there, "The people were in fact the fountain of all power." We understand that from the Declaration as well, that government derives its just powers from the consent of the governed. We, the people, are the source of all power here. So the people were the fountain of all power. By resorting to them, all difficulties were got over. They could alter constitutions as they pleased. Which means if they hadn't done that, he's recognizing we couldn't alter constitutions as we pleased. But by turning it over to the people. And then the last one here, "The plan to be framed and proposed was to be submitted to the people themselves." The disapprobation, which means disapproval, of this supreme authority would destroy it forever. If the people disapprove, then the Constitution's gone. Doesn't matter. But if they do approve, even if we didn't have the authority to create it, once the people approve it, it's granted retroactive authority and legitimacy. That is the precedent. A convention of the states, and that's what the founders called it, by the way. The 1787 convention was called a convention of the states repeatedly. And yet it transformed it into a convention of we the people, exercising the ultimate sovereign right of the people to abolish or alter. So what's your name for this, Ed? This is the doctrine of?
The sovereign delegate doctrine.
Sovereign delegate doctrine. The delegates to a convention represent the sovereign power of the people themselves and cannot be limited. That's the precedent that has been upheld in state courts ever since, when the states have their own constitutional conventions and when the state legislatures try to limit those conventions. They can't be limited. In fact, we even have a slide on that on slide number 12. The members of a constitutional convention are the direct representatives of the people. And as such, their power may not in any respect be limited or restrained by the legislature. Now, granted, that is not what the Convention of States people are promising our state legislators, just the opposite. That this is the legal precedent, though. The legal precedent, the historical precedent, exactly the opposite of what they're selling our state legislators. Now, in some states, it's actually a felony to lie to state legislators. I'd be interested if that's the case in Montana.
Apparently not, because I've certainly seen plenty of lies to state legislators.
Yeah. Maybe we need that kind of a lie. I don't know.
Well, you know, and this is a thing that most people need to understand, is the present day, America 2023, and you brought this up, the doxing, the Antifas, the CRT, all the things that are going on today in this country that intimidate and change people's perspectives in a way that isn't really accurate. This is about the world's worst time in our history to try to do something like this, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. As I've said before, where we stand right now with the Constitution, we have the high ground if we just choose to enforce it. This is the opportunity for them to take away that high ground from us. The Constitution isn't the problem. And I've often referred to those promoting a convention, they're the blame the Constitution crowd. They're the ones that want to blame the Constitution for our problems rather than taking personal responsibility. We, the people, have not been enforcing the Constitution. It's a crazy idea. In fact, Madison talks about this in Federalist 48 and 49. He talks about, in 48, he talks about the Constitution is merely parchment barriers. It's just a piece of paper. It can't enforce itself. In Federalist 49, he asks the question, should we use a convention for, his words, correcting breaches of the Constitution? And he says that's a dangerous idea. This is totally an invalid way to use the Article 5 Convention. It's for correcting errors in the Constitution. But when the Constitution isn't the problem, changing it is not the solution. It's time to enforce the Constitution, not change it.
Well, we've talked about that. The Constitution is not a living document. Very quickly, address that, because we hear the Constitution is a living document. That's not true.
Correct. Absolutely. It's a contract. And you have to compare this to, if your home mortgage contract were a living document, would you be comfortable with that? Would you sign on to a living document that they can change at any time and you're now bound by the new changes? Of course not. The Constitution is a contract. It's an agreement that is solid until formally changed. And frankly, that's what I'm concerned about them trying to do right now. They've usurped it. They've bypassed it. But if they can formally change it, we'll lose that high ground. The Constitution is what it is and is what it is intended to be until formally changed.
No, that's right. A framework of law, and we are not a democracy. We are a republic, aren't we?
That's right.
Well, gentlemen, we're running out of time. Thank you both for being our guests. Robert, talk very quickly. The JBS.org, they can find your Constitution is the Solution on that website, and they can follow your programs, can't they?
Absolutely. You'll find information on the dangers of an Article 5 convention in there. You'll find things supporting nullification and its historical basis and how it's been used hundreds of times in our history. There's a lot of great material on there. We don't need a convention. We need to understand the Constitution and demand adherence to it. The Constitution is the Solution video series is available on JBS.org. That's a great place to start. Learn the Constitution, and then we can demand they follow it.
Okay, well, gentlemen, thank you. And I want to invite our listeners, our followers, to join us again next Tuesday for Connecting the Dots.